Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined by Katie Schaefer to discuss the movie adaptation of 1922, which came out in 2017. 2017 was a very, very busy Stephen King year, and this was a Netflix original, so we're going to be diving into the details here. If you haven't watched it yet, go check it out on Netflix and come back to this, but Katie, how are you doing today?
Great, great. I actually just finished watching this a little while ago, and I have read the short story, so I am ready to talk about this really, really depressing one.
Yeah, this has such a small cast, too. And here's the thing. Thomas Jane stars as Wilfred, who is, you know, the main character in this, and I often forget he was in Dreamcatcher, mostly because I forget there's a Dreamcatcher movie all the time.
Probably should, from what I've heard about it. And he's in The Mist.
That is one I really enjoyed. But
yes,
one thing I noticed in this, and tell me if I have completely lost my mind here, but it felt like he either decided to do this or was told to do this by a director to talk as if his jaw were wired shut.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if that, obviously, if it's a directorial decision or his. You know, Thomas Jane is one of those actors who can, I kind of think of him as like a Nicolas Cage or a John Cusack without quite as much wild variations in his acting, but there's still, he gets cast in a lot of B movies, which I wouldn't necessarily qualify this as that, but when it's needed, he can really, really pull off a totally different character than you've seen in something else. And that he does that in this. And that's kind of what it felt like in how, after he made True Grit, Jeff Bridges kind of affected that verbal mannerism in all of his movies.
Yeah.
Which is a very mumbly, it's like he doesn't have any teeth or something, which he definitely does. But that's what it felt like. It felt like an actor choice. Mm-hmm. But a director would definitely have had to go along with it. And it did feel accurate to someone. I didn't grow up around farms, but I am from the Midwest and have met my fair share of longtime farmers. And it's not unusual for them to have that kind of mumbly thing going on. So
I feel like they had to overdub a lot of this movie, though, because of it, because I was hearing the words and I was like, your mouth is like not moving like a mouth normally does when you talk. And you could literally hear him talking and you could see that his teeth were like clenched shut at times. And honestly, this is probably like my biggest complaint from the movie, because it did make him very hard to understand. Like, I had to put the subtitles on because he would be talking to Henry and I was just like, what are you saying?
He does use a really heavy Midwestern accent. So that's also part of it. Was I've grown up in around the Midwestern accent, and in parts of Minnesota is real heavy. So, but I was like, subtitles for this, because it is really intense. I think it works for the character. It really is especially because his voice is narrating so much of this. And it's such a distinctive voice. I think it works. But yes, it's definitely, sir, could you speak up, sir? Maybe open your mouth when you speak.
Yeah. And you really don't have a ton of characters in this movie. You have him as Wilfred. You have Molly Parker as Arlette, who I recognized from House of Cards. You have Dylan Schmid playing Henry, Caitlin Bernard playing Shannon, and Neil McDonough playing his neighbor Harlan, who I think, aside from Thomas Jane, probably the most recognizable face in this.
Yes, yep. He's like second on the IMDb, which is always ranked by how big you are.
Yeah, so even though he's not in it a whole lot, you instantly are like, oh yes, this guy, he's here, you know, and you kind of can tell right away what kind of character he's going to play as Harlan, especially for those of us who have read the novella, which is collected in Full Dark, No Stars.
Yes,
I think
it is. I remember because I had to buy the book to read it.
Yeah. So this was a pretty faithful adaptation. Stephen King really loves shoving people down wells.
He does. Wells are dangerous in Stephen King books. If one comes up, someone's going down it.
This is like the reverse of Dolores Claiborne, almost, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Instead of wife planning to kill husband, husband plans to kill wife, you know?
Yes, for much, much less valid reasons.
And they both fall down a well.
Yes, we understand and sympathize why Dolores kills her husband. Yes. And you're like, that's probably good. Probably the best choice. In this, it's like, sir, no, please, please stop doing what you're doing. Like, no justification for this.
They both claim to have done it for their children. But the difference with 1922 is that Wilfred pulls Henry into it and makes Henry take part in this. Whereas in Dolores Claiborne, she's like, I am going to take care of this and no one is going to know.
Exactly. And she's much better planner than Wilfred is.
Yeah, he's not the brightest. And you see how everything goes downhill so quickly after this, you know, to dive into the story. Basically, his wife comes into some land from her father, which would then result in coming into some money as well, because she wants to sell the land. He does not want her to sell the land. I'm not 100% sure why. I don't know if the movie ever really makes that clear. I think the novella does a better job of that. But here it's like the people who want to buy it, he just really hates. He's like, Farrington cannot have it.
Yeah, it's because they'll ruin the water, because they'll dump all of their waste into the stream, because that's what people did then. And the stream would be, his house is downstream from the pig factory, and so he won't have good water anymore, which will ruin his farm.
Yeah, and because Stephen King loves to make his connections, we get the Hemingford home mention, you know, so that is a place that anyone who has read The Stand will be familiar with, and obviously this takes place a little bit before The Stand.
50 years or so, you know.
So story-wise, this is pretty straightforward. We kind of outline the entire plot, but then as things start to go downhill, Henry gets the neighbor girl pregnant and they're like 15. And, you know, this is the 20s. So this was much more common back then, obviously.
Yeah.
But Harlan, not happy about it, sends her into the city, basically, to this girl's home where she's going to have the baby and then the baby will be put up for adoption. And Henry starts to resent his dad for making him do what he did and therefore thinks he does not need to listen to his father and decides to do something very stupid. And he goes all Bonnie and Clyde and
yep.
It does not end well for them either.
Nope. Everybody pays for what happens that night.
Yeah, and we see things get worse because the rats are coming. You know, this is Arlette's way of haunting Wilfred in particular, which they never really made that super clear. They just kind of, yeah, in the movie made it seem like there was a rat problem because we see the rats down with her in the well. And let's not forget about all the cows in this movie that suffer of this man's choice. And you have just one bad thing after another happening. You see he ends up with a caved-in roof for the barn. There's a chunk of the roof missing for the house that he is living in. He has to have his hand amputated because of one of the rat bites getting infected. And he goes crawling over to Harlan, almost quite literally, because his car won't start. And
right.
It's just so crazy. But for you, how did you feel about this as an adaptation of the story itself?
So I was writing an article about King back in 2017, before this came out, that wasn't due until like right after this premiered. So I'd read the story before I watched this. And it's as close to a spot-on adaptation as you're going to get. And I think I kind of hoped that's what we were going to get, something like Apt Pupil or The Body, which is Stand By Me. Because his novellas in particular, because this is what, like 40 pages, maybe?
I think it's a little longer, but I don't think it's like too terribly long. I'm not sure off the top of my head, because, you know, there's hardcovers and paperbacks and none of the pages ever line up.
No, they don't. But I thought it was really good as an adaptation. It is a dark dark story. It feels very Richard Bachman-esque, you know, if you think of what he was writing when he was using that surname or that pen name. I knew everything that was going to happen, but I was still just cringing throughout the whole thing. Like, oh God, it's coming.
I think Fair Extension is the shortest novella in Full Dark, No Stars. So I do think 1922 is a little longer, maybe somewhere around 100 to 140 pages okay. or something, given the length of the book. It doesn't say exactly on Wikipedia or anything, but, you know, it's not too terribly long. A lot of his novellas fall into that sort of like 150-ish page range, I want to say, because if you right. look at the collections, any novella collection has four. And, you know, yes. it's they come in around 400 or 500 pages typically. I have the hardcover for Elevation, which is, you know, this cute little hardcover. That's 146 pages, but it has pictures and it's smaller size than a normal hardcover. So, you know, his novellas tend to be a very good length for movie adaptations.
Yeah, because a novella is technically, according to the people who make these choices, between 17,500 to 39,999 words. 40,000 and over is a novella. And a short story is between 20 and 75 or 7,500 words. So, and he got, and I think in between the two is called a novelette, but I've seen that used very rarely. Usually they just round up to novella at that point.
Yeah.
And I think his novellas very often produce fabulous scripts, because that's roughly, a script is roughly 120 to 140 pages of, you know, screenplay, not a book.
And that's for roughly a 90 to 120 minute movie.
Yep, exactly. So usually it seems that they are able to work out to make it so that it's a pretty spot on adaptation while making adjustments for things that either can't be filmed because for whatever reason, or to make the story flow better in a visual medium, because so much of King's work, and we've talked about this before, is it's all very interior.
Yes.
So it's inside the characters' heads. And this story is made easier because of the narration. And I think the only place is that it can feel very slow, because there's a lot of scenes of him standing in one place and looking off into the distance, or, you know, having an emotional reaction, or we're watching, you know, him and Henry look at each other. There's a lot of that is set to the narration so that there's time for it to be explained. Mm-hmm. I think that works for something like this, because it is a very dark movie. And when the violence and bad things happen, it is always shocking. Even if you know it's, you know, they're going to kill her.
Yeah.
But it's still horrible when it happens.
The format is fairly similar to Shawshank, in my opinion, because you have a bunch of narration in that adaptation as well as in the novella. And I think because he's writing this confession out and we're seeing it play out as he writes it, the narration works better for that. Whereas, you know, there was some narration in the 2004 Salem's Lot that just didn't work for me. And this, it worked better. And I think it's partially because I was able to mostly understand what was being said in the narration parts. And
right. Once you turn the subtitles on, you're like, oh, okay, that's what you were saying. That didn't sound like that.
Really, that was like kind of the struggling point for me with this. And the only like difference I really noticed was at the end, he's not a librarian. Like the ends of these two are very different. And this movie actually ends with the line, like, in the end, we all get caught. And it doesn't necessarily mean by the law. It's just everything catches up to you. And I really liked that ending because the novella ends with, like, his obituary.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Or at least some newspaper clipping. I don't know if it was the obituary or just, like, a little news piece, but
yeah, like, the use of the rats in this is very pointed, as the first time we hear them, or there's anything brought in, is when he opens the well and to dump her body down, and he looks down into it and he hears the squeaking, just this, just a little bit. And then that just slowly increases, and then we start to see the rats. And it seems like in any scene where he starts to see rats and doesn't immediately leave the area or do something else, they come to him, the people who he's either murdered or killed through his murder start showing up. And, you know, the very end of the movie is we see all three of them, and it's pretty graphic. Those rats really ate that kid's face.
They did a very nice job with those gore effects, too. I mean, obviously, when Arlette's in the well, she doesn't look remotely real, but
no.
I personally have never seen a decomposing dead body, so I can't really speak to what that would actually look like.
Yeah, I'm fine with not knowing that.
Yeah, especially, you know, I imagine at one point that well was used, so maybe there's still some moisture down there, and obviously you have the rats, and they keep it covered, so it's like shaded. You know, there's all these different factors coming into how her body is decomposing. And when she has this moment later before the end where she comes down the stairs after he's fallen down the stairs and there's all the rats.
Yep.
That was really good, too, because we didn't need her to look like realistic in those moments.
No.
Because she's dead and dead people don't come back to life. You know, she wasn't necessarily zombified either. So, you know, you
right.
could kind of play with that. And I think they visually did a nice job with this movie, given the time period and, you know, kind of getting all of that stuff right.
Yeah. And I think I didn't need that to be realistic, because the whole conceit of the film is whether or not this haunting that's happening is in his head or is some kind of supernatural manifestation. And it never answers that question. We never know if it's real or not. I mean, it's real enough to him that he suffers tragically, and it's real enough that he blames that for all the downfall. But we never see Henry have those moments, and that she tells him what happens to Henry is the most convincing thing to tell us that this is real, because we then see Henry's body, and that is what happened to mm-hmm. him, and he finds all that out well before. So I liked that ambiguity, and I liked that they kind of freeze Arlette in time with that level of gore, because that's the most traumatic moment for him. It's not the afterwards. It's like, this is the trauma that you caused both yourself and your son, and you killed your wife, and like, this is what you remember looking down into the well at. So I think it works to be to that for that look.
Yeah, it really does. And the only other thing that I think maybe didn't come across as well with this adaptation is when I was reading the novella, he felt like a very unreliable narrator.
Yes.
But this was just very straightforward. This is what happened. And I feel like we didn't get quite as much with the conniving man as I think the novella leads you to believe there is, because you could tell when he would have these moments, but it was never really super pronounced. So it just felt like he was being himself.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
It wasn't like Secret Window.
Right. For me, when I was reading the novella, it felt very like Lolita. Lolita is the quintessential unreliable narrator in the way that the narrator thinks he's doing nothing wrong, mm-hmm. you know, or if it is wrong, it's just because society thinks it's wrong, when for any other human being, it's disgusting and horrendous what he's doing. And I got a little bit of a sense of that with this story, in that Arlette always comes off looking like a terrible mother, a terrible person, terrible wife, selfish and greedy. And we never see anything from her side. And he specifically says that, you know, far more than the crime that haunted him was that he essentially manipulates his son into participating in it. So I never have sympathy for his character. And I think they do a good job, even in this adaptation, not as well as they do in the book, of selling that, of like, yeah, this guy can say all of these things, but that doesn't mean that he should be sympathized with. Like, he's still a terrible person.
Arlette wasn't the best person. I think that's made clear when she's drunk and, you know, kind of just making fun of Henry for no real reason, you know, just because he likes the neighbor girl and...
Right, and says gross things.
She's trying to embarrass him, and it's like, who are you trying to embarrass him in front of? Like, it's just the two of you and him. And it just kind of gave you this gross feeling. And you were like, okay, this family is a little off kilter here, you know? So right. It's not even that she was a sympathetic character either. I think Henry by far is the most, Henry and Shannon, that is, because you're never really given a reason to like Harlan. You don't see enough of his wife to like her either. But you have, you know, the sheriff comes in and, oh my goodness, the banker. You don't need $35. You need $750, which to you and I does not sound like a lot. But in 1922, that was a lot of money.
In 1922, it was about the equivalent of... And I looked at this and I was both shocked at how much it is and how little is. $750 in 1922 was about $12,000. So, I mean, with our inflation, that's still nothing to make improvements on your house. Like, you ain't getting a roof for $12,000 today is all I'm saying. But maybe. It's still a...
Depends on the size.
If you've got a real small, if you have a very small roof or it's not that badly damaged, but...
His had a hole in it at some point. And he had the barn with a giant hole in it.
Right. And, you know, once he loses his hand, all of those dreams are over. You can't farm, in those days, especially one-handed. I'm sure today there's all kinds of things you can do to make it work. But by yourself, like in the Midwest winters where the snow, like when he runs outside, he's like, I'm gonna go drive. I was like, honey, no, you're gonna die. Like, you're not gonna survive the exposure, even if town is like 2 miles away. Cause that kind of blowing wind, and I've been in Nebraska when it's storming and the winds, they'll close the highways because the winds are so strong that they can blow cars off the highways.
And he had to crank his car to start it.
Yep. That was the other thing. That car is a Model T. It is not going to start in, you know, blowing snow. And it's probably 20 degrees, maybe, depending on what time of year it is. So it shows how far gone he is mentally. Because that's the other thing that continues to decay is his mind. And you can kind of tell from the moment where he decides he's going to manipulate Henry into helping him kill his wife, that is the point when he really breaks as a human being, and only bad things can happen after that.
Yeah. You also have this scenario where, you know, Harlan's like, you have to pay, you know, part of the $300 that it's going to cost him to send Shannon to this home. And he's like, you know what? Pay $75 because right. Wilfred's like, well, Arlette cleaned me out and so on and so forth. And we all know that's not true, but he's keeping up the lie really well, surprisingly well, I think. And, you know, he finds $40 shoved away in her hat liner, you know, so he was going all around the house trying to look for it, but she got to it first and hid it away because, you know, he was like going through the sugar or something or the grains or something.
Yeah, the sugar and the flour. Yeah.
And you see her doing it and taking it because you see like the floral print of her dress or something and you know. And then right. he's at the bank and, you know, that whole 35 needs to be 750 scenario happens and he ends up taking the 750. But because, like you said, he loses his hand, none of that stuff's going to happen. And you get the impression that, sure, he paid off his 75 and then still had 90% of the money left. Well, more than 90, I guess, since he had the 40 that he found. But you can tell he just sort of drank it.
Yep, and because that's what he says when he sells the, it took him 2 years to drink his way through that 100 acres.
Because he had the loan and then he sold the farm for dirt cheap.
Yep, and the 100 acres went for more, I think, is what it's implying. It's so sad, but also you're kind of like, well,
you did this to yourself.
Yeah, I mean, and what the truly terrible thing is what happens to that poor kid. Like, Henry just gets so screwed in this, and it's so depressing.
I will give Wilfred this. He specifically told Henry, don't go and do something stupid. And that is immediately what he did. I was like, okay, I will give him credit for that. But a lot of unlikable characters in this. King is very good at writing unlikable characters, in my opinion. Yeah. You know, the bullies in the body, the bullies in It, and just the villains in general, you know, like the husband in Dolores Claiborne, and, you know.
Right. Or the manager in The Shining is a perfect example, because he's not a villain. No. He's just an asshole.
He's in it so briefly, but he's so unlikable in that brief time period.
Right. That I remember him, and I remember this moment being like, oh yeah, that's one of King's, for me, iconic bad guys, because he's there for like maybe three pages, and you just, and it's not like Jack is a good person, but you still hate him on behalf of Jack because he's just so, so icky.
Yeah, it is really something else when he writes unlikable characters. I'm like, how many people do you dislike? You know, like,
yeah,
who of these exactly. do you know?
Yeah. How many people? I mean, he probably meets a lot of people, so he probably has a lot of like, this guy's going to be a character.
Yeah.
Or an amalgamation of several annoying people that he meets and takes all their bad characteristics and puts it into one person.
Yes. Well, you and I can both hear the thunder rumbling here at my house, and I don't think we have really too much to say about this. I thought it was a perfectly fine adaptation. I gave it a 3 out of 5, which, you know, it happens.
I would say that's about where I'm at on this one. Maybe 3.5, honestly, because I think it's gorgeously shot. Like, holy shit, the cinematography in this is perfect. All of the filters and the lighting and the sunsets. Like, you can, I'm pretty sure at least some of this was actually shot outside, probably a lot of it, which is always a treat for me when I get to see that these days anyway. So I really enjoyed it, and I was looking forward to rewatching it. It's not a pleasant movie.
Yeah, I liked it. I did not have fun with it. I probably would not rewatch it. So, you know, thank you for rewatching it for this podcast.
It's been since 2017, and I wanted to show my husband anyway, because I was like, this is such a great example of a King adaptation of one of King's nasty little stories, because he's so good at those nasty little stories.
That whole collection is nasty little stories.
Yep, exactly. So it's just, and I like, you know, movies that don't necessarily, you know, one of my favorite movies in the world is Mother, which is not a movie that is ever going to make anybody feel good, because, oh boy, it's hard. But this kind of falls into that category of like, what is going on with this really terrible character? So that's why I was able to watch it again, we'll say. It's not, I didn't enjoy it, but I was fascinated, like I was the first time.
Yeah, I am kind of going through and taking my Letterboxd rankings and then taking a look at how fun it is and like how rewatchable it is, in my opinion. And then I'm going to like compile those three things and kind of make like a ultimate rankings list, if you will. I'm going to do the books a little differently, because rereading a book is completely different from rewatching, you know, The Shining or Shawshank or something like that, you know. But it's been interesting, because I'm like, this was a perfectly fine movie. Don't ever want to watch it again, you know. Or you have something like the Dead Zone TV series or the Under the Dome TV series, and it's like, that was a lot. Not doing that again. It was fine for the Dead Zone, not so fine for Under the Dome.
But, no, you know, no, that's sort of like, don't even, just, or like the Golden Years, like, just don't waste your time. Please don't do that. Watch, you know, The Simpsons for the 17th time if you have to, if you're desperate for something to watch.
But just going through, because I was actually doing that earlier today before we recorded this episode, and just kind of thinking about those extra criteria, because I don't really consider if I'm going to rewatch something when I first watch it and rate it, because one, I don't rewatch a ton of things, but like, you know, you and I just recently talked about the Loki series on my other podcast, and it's like a lot of the Marvel movies are rewatchable, some definitely aren't, but you know, there are definitely those King adaptations that are rewatchable. There are ones that you'd pretend didn't exist, and then there are ones like this that are good but don't make you feel good, so you don't really want to watch them a ton. And
one experience is enough.
Yeah. And so it'll be interesting to see how I feel about some of the newer stuff, like the Pet Sematary remake, because sometimes I just get excited for these things the first time I watch them, like that and yes. It Chapter 2. So then now that I've like reset my brain here and have, you know, source material behind me and everything, it'll be interesting to see how I feel about those on a rewatch, because I watched those when they came out. And, you know, some of the stuff I had watched before I even thought about starting this podcast, obviously not those, because those were like 2019. So that was like...
The first one was 2017.
Yeah. But Pet Sematary and It Chapter 2, I believe, were both 2019. Right. So I had started the podcast and had probably read the source material for those two by then. But, you know, it's just been fun and very interesting to see how I feel about certain things that I've had to either reread or rewatch for this because of how much time has passed right. And how much more I know about King now. So this one, good, not super great because of the subject matter. It's just a tough one in general. And I think the short story collection is also a very tough read if you're reading through all four back to back to back to back. And, you know, Katie, thank you again for rewatching this. It was fun. I hope I didn't get too long-winded here at the end, but always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. And I did want to say, if you haven't watched it yet and you have trauma experiences around domestic violence, this might not be a movie for you. For the love of God, this is one of King's that I would stray from. Like, more than a couple. So, but thank you for having me. It was still a good discussion, regardless of that the movie is bleak. Bleak as hell.
He has some bleak stories, but
yes,
you will be back soon because you're always back. So
I am. So thanks again.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Sematary. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Sematary sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Sematary on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.